On this episode of My Adventure in Space and Time.
And you saw the Doctor involved in fisticuffs.
Listen, it was tonally wacky.
Clearly, you know, they're in love with each other. They never get it on.
Yeah, it was kind of odd, but it was funny. Welcome to My Adventure in Space and Time, a modern Whovian's journey through classic Who. I'm Shona, I'm that Whovian, and I'm joined today by Andy Thorpe. Hello.
Hello.
You know, if you wave.
They might still get the gesture.
I forgot to tell you that this is an audio medium, and I'm really sorry about that.
I wouldn't have bothered dressing up.
Yeah, I know, and you do look really dapper, not that anyone will know, apart from
no
me.
No one will ever know.
Yeah, well... Yeah. Oh, well, I'm sorry. Okay, so how did you get into Doctor Who? This is weird for me to ask because...
You
I've known
already
you for...
know the answer.
No, I don't. That's the point. I don't know the answer because I've known you for quite a while and we talk about Doctor Who a lot and I have no idea how you got into Doctor Who.
Okay. Well, it's not a very long or complicated story, unfortunately. I remember very distinctly my mother sitting me down in front of the telly and I had no idea what I was watching. She didn't say, you know, like, you know, this is this amazing show. It's been going for so many years. You know, it's adventure. It's space. It's time. She didn't preface it at all. She just sat me down, locked the door, went away. And I was in the world of Doctor Who and it was Sylvester McCoy. I had no idea really what to make of it. All my initial memories are just odd. You know, if Doctor Who never came back, I would just think of it as a very odd show that I never really understood. I didn't really understand it at all. And I was looking at the dates today. Sylvester McCoy, he stopped in 89, I think. That's when it was cancelled. I was only three, or four perhaps. And so I can't have actually watched, you know, that much at all. Yet it stayed, the memory was still very vivid. But it left such an impression on me that when it was coming back, I was very, very excited. I was incredibly excited when Paul McGann was announced and the movie was coming out. And again, my mum sat me down in front of the TV and said, you're going to enjoy this. And I was a bit heartbroken because there was all this hype around it. And then nothing materialised. I mean, we had the one kind of movie, but the idea, I think, was for more to happen, for it to become like a big American, British kind of huge series. And that never happened. And bloody Paul McGann is just so gorgeous as the Doctor. It could have been, I think. I mean, I'm such a fan of his audio series with him and the wonderful Sheldon Smith. And then, so then I waited again. And again, I remember being at home, even though this time I was probably, I think I was at art school or something about this stage. And again, I remember sitting down in the living room, my mum there saying, I think you're going to enjoy this. It was bloody Christopher Eccleston. And from there on, you know, I haven't stopped watching.
It was only bloody Christopher Eccleston.
And he was amazing. And everything from them has since been amazing. And it was the first time it kind of clicked. It made sense. Because I knew when my mum sat us down that this was an important show, that this was something that, you know, had real value. I didn't understand where it came from, watching Sylvester McCoy lark about on the top of a poop deck. But I still knew that, you know, this is something, you should watch it, you should enjoy it. But it only really properly clicked when it came back, because obviously when it came back, it was brilliant. And although I'm incredibly fond of the movie, it's not necessarily peak Doctor Who.
Well, and don't give me any spoilers though, because not that, I mean, it's going to be so long before I get to the movie, but my theory is that that will be like the last bit of classic Who that I'll watch.
Well, yeah. But yeah, I think it's a wonderful show, and I rarely meet that many people that kind of, you know, are into it. But when you do, I think it's kind of quite special. I mean, I say that as in it's one of the worldwide incredibly popular thing. But still, you know, when you mention to people at work, you know, about Doctor Who,
it's not a given that people will like it.
No.
Or even like really know it. It's really not.
No, and I think perhaps there was during maybe the Russell T. Davis kind of thing when it became a huge, huge hit, but it's kind of seems slightly differently now. People have grown up, I guess. It's terrific. And then from then on, I've kind of gone back and tried to watch bits and pieces from the past, tried to kind of understand the full story. Not that there is one story, not that it actually makes sense. And it's good that it doesn't make sense, you know. It's good that, you know, he has this granddaughter who might not actually be his granddaughter, and so forth and so on, you know. I love all the different contradictions between each era and each Doctor. And when you do meet someone who does love Doctor Who and they keep banging on about canon, then I kind of tune out because I'm not that fussed about it, because it's just pure escapism. And when everything is going terribly, I always know I can sit down and watch Doctor Who. And, you know, I will forget whatever and just be purely entertained and enthralled and, you know, just taken away to somewhere different, as cheesy as that probably sounds.
I was thinking when you were saying about realising that it was something very important, it's weird that, because I didn't grow up with Doctor Who or classic, like, well, I started watching in 2005, so I was a teenager. You know, I was aware that it existed, but I didn't really have any other connection to it. But I still was aware it was something, it still felt very important. I don't know if it's just so like entrenched in British popular culture that's just, I don't know, that's just a given. It's nice though, it does feel special.
Yeah, it does.
Okay, so the other thing I want to talk about, Russell T. Davis, because I think...
I've heard some rumours. I think I might know what you're about to say.
I'm glad I've got you to talk about it too, because we were in the same room when I got the message from regular guest, social media extraordinaire Cassie, telling me, and I really thought, why is she sending me this? This is surely a clickbait article. That's absurd. And it was not. And I was able to tell yourself in the room what had happened. And also because I know you, like me, are a big fan of Russell T. Davis's work as well. So it's especially exciting.
It was. It felt like an April Fool's joke.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was like, well, that's honestly, it didn't even seem like a good joke, because I was like, no, that's not even, that would never happen.
and yet it is. And I still don't quite know. I still feel very contradicted about it, even though I keep seeing photos of him beaming with smiles standing next to, you know, Broken Dalek or what have you. And he's obviously over the moon to be back, and he's such a wonderful person. But it still seems like a completely unexpected decision.
Are you generally feeling good about it, though?
Well, you have to be. I mean, because it's Russell T. Davis, and he's a brilliant writer, and he's such a huge Doctor Who fan, it can't possibly go wrong. None of his work, all of his work is not just progressive in its nature, but he hasn't repeated himself. He's got lots of strong themes going through it, like, you know, from Queer as Folk to It's a Sin. But he's not just telling the same story with that. He's continuing the story or developing the story. So I imagine it'll be similar with Doctor Who. He's not just going to rehash old ideas, you know. He's going to be taking it somewhere forwards.
You're so right. He doesn't repeat himself. That's a really good point. Yeah. I know, I was sort of weirdly conflicted as well. Like, I mean, my first instinct was just obviously so excited I'll watch anything he writes. And I read The Writer's Tale last year. I don't know if I ever talk about that, about how I read The Writer's Tale.
Once or twice you mention it.
Sort of took over my life.
It's a good book, though. It's a good book.
Well, I really love the way he talks about writing characters, especially.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go into it, but for all those reasons, of course, I was just immediately so excited and like, oh my God, what are we going to get? It's going to be incredible. Mm. But also I had this tiny little kind of thing niggling at me where I was worried that maybe people that have been complaining about the recent run were being pandered to, or I think I was worried, oh, it's like the BBC are making like a safe choice. And I was like, maybe it was me and you talking about this, and we were like, no, but they think they're making a safe choice, but he's not gonna
do that.
He's always gonna be pushing things forward. He's not gonna repeat himself. He's just I don't think he's that kind of writer or that kind of creative person.
And it's a big risk for him, because he's going back, and if he does a bad job, then just like any writer of Doctor Who, he's going to be slated. And he's got even more pressure than a brand new writer, because he is such a legacy that he's kind of built up. And so for him to accept, you know, their offer or however it went down, must have been a big deal for him. Because it means he can't, for the next few years, write any of the dramas that presumably he was planning to. So there must be something. It probably seems like a simple thing from the outside for him to do, but you know, I imagine it's not a small undertaking. The only thing that I was still kind of slightly worried about, and I say this as somebody who knows nothing about TV production, but just like in the small print, that now it's not going to be just a BBC thing. Mm. It's going to be, the production is going to be shared with Bad Wolf. And does it feel like the BBC is kind of outsourcing it a wee bit? And like, why would you do that for one of your most precious, successful, internationally well-known kind of things?
I don't know enough about this either, but also I'm wondering if it's the other way round, and if Bad Wolf have kind of jumped in to be like,
yeah,
I know you want to do that, but
yeah.
Because I know Russell T Davies has been quite vocally critical of the BBC and how he considers the BBC to be under attack. But I don't know the ins and outs of it enough, but I am comforted by the fact that it's the production company that's Julie Gardner and what's her name? Jane something. You know, the Doctor Who producers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's not like they're just selling it to the highest bidder or something. They are giving it to people for what they're doing.
It's in safe hands, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's just kind of down the road, once they start losing control or giving it to other people, is it going to be a repeat of kind of, you know,
where
it ended in the first place? And that's what I'm scared about. I don't want that to happen.
Sure.
But I doubt that.
On that foreboding note.
Yeah.
All right. Should we talk about this episode?
Yeah, come on then.
Go on then. Okay, so we're looking at the Romans.
We're talking about the Romans.
Yeah. And I want to say as well, I was thinking that, you know, they don't make historicals like they used to. They don't make pure historicals anymore. And I'm slightly, not stealing this, but I did have it on my mind because the last episode of Verity podcast, which is my, you know, which I don't make any secret of, is my favorite Doctor Who podcast. They were talking about historicals and the difference between pure historicals and pseudo-historical, I don't know, historicals that are like have an alien presence, like what's a good example? Like Vincent and the Doctor, you know, there's still like an alien in it. We had the Aztecs in series one, which is and the Romans now in series two, where it's there, you know, it's just in Rome.
There's I kept waiting for the sci-fi.
There was no sci-fi.
For you know, a ship to, you know, crash, or an alien to be revealed. I know there wasn't going to be any Sonic Screwdriver action coming, but you know, I thought there might be some sort of kind of little gizmo.
No.
None. None at all.
None to be found.
No.
Let me do a little a little synopsis. It's pretty short. So we are in Rome 64 AD, and they're all kind of, they're living a life of luxury. Barbara and Ian are kind of, they're kind of happy to relax, whereas the doctor and Vicky are, they want to go off on an adventure. And the doctor is mistaken for a famous musician and ends up in the courts of Emperor Nero in the middle of a conspiracy and accidentally inspires him to burn Rome. Ian and Barbara, in the meantime, are captured by slave traders, and Barbara ends up as an assistant to the Empress, and Ian ends up fighting in the arena. And then their paths cross, and they manage to escape together, and they all meet back in the life of luxury again. Really, yeah, that kind of that covers it, right?
If you talk about each, what each character has to go through, it's quite dark.
Yeah, but and it's a comedy.
And yeah, exactly. It's a complete farce. Like, most of the action takes place in this, there's probably a good phrase for this sort of kind of farce, but it's this long corridor. You know, there's so much sort of kind of misdirection, and, you know, they're about to bump into each other, but they don't.
Yeah.
And, you know, and yeah, it's completely farcical. It's incredibly funny. But at the same time, you know, they're sold into slavery. Barbara nearly gets raped.
Barbara, God.
And also poisoned. And you know, old Action Ian is is nearly killed several times as a surprisingly adept gladiator.
Can I say as well about, I wanted to say something about the sword fight, because do you remember in one of the episodes early on, I can't remember what's going on, but they're walking past a couple of guys kind of practicing sword fighting.
Yeah.
And it's the worst fucking thing I've ever seen. Yeah. And they look,
it's like kids with sticks.
Oh yeah. And they're so bad. And you're like, they're gonna die. They're not gonna last a second. So when we got to Ian versus Delos, it was really good. And you know what, Andy? I don't know how much of Classic Who you've seen of Hartnell's era, but I'm going to tell you now, the fights are rarely that good. Like, this is the best one I've seen. Like, it was not bad. Like, considering, I think the best thing I could compare it to was just in the nature of the fight was the Aztecs. Which, and listen, right, in this fight, they're not even trying to hurt each other because they're mates, and they don't, you know, they don't want to kill the other. And that fight still looks incredible. Whereas in the Aztecs, like, they're literally, you know, they're honestly fighting for their lives. Yeah, and it looks so bad. Like, I don't know. But I think it really seems like season two had a much bigger budget, and maybe they got some decent choreography in there, you know, some lessons. I don't know, but it looked much better than I was expecting. Yeah. But yeah, I know what you mean. Like, I did read that this was the first one that was, and I don't really know what's meant by this, because there is humor in, you know, in the other episodes. I have heard it said that this one was the first one that was kind of played as a comedy. Like, there's gags in it.
Oh, yeah.
It was kind of weird, because some of the stuff was really dark and was kind of given the weight it deserved. And then other times, like, I was thinking when poor, the guy, that poor guy that's like Nero's assistant.
What is his name?
I don't remember. Tigellinus, something like that. It's that poor guy that, again, there's another comedy bit right at the start when we first meet Nero, where Nero keeps moving around his bedroom, and this poor guy is trying to put his crown on his head, and he's like trying to run around the room after him, and it's kind of funny. And then when the poisoning debacle happens, he ends up getting poisoned and dying instead, and it's just like whoops.
It really reminded me of Carry On films. Because, Nero's personal servant, you know, always trying to chase him around, always doing the good thing, but always kind of making a mistake. And in the end, he drinks the poison, drops down dead. Nobody cares.
Yeah.
It's played for laughs.
Whereas, like, I can't think of an episode before now where someone dying was played for comedy. And I don't think it would, I'm not sure it would happen in modern Who either.
No, no.
Yeah. Or even how dark some of it was, I don't think. Because, listen, like, I know a lot of modern Who is, it's not that there's not, there aren't dark things that happen and people die and people are, are, and people live for, like, two that are trapped in places for millions of years and stuff. But I was just thinking when poor Barbara was being, like, sold as a slave, and the implications of that are really horrible. And I was like, they wouldn't even do this in modern Who, though. And no. Much less, not that those bits were played for comedy, but it wouldn't have a place even in a dramatic modern Who episode, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, completely. And I think with the early ones, it's much more apparent, or maybe this is nonsense, that it is a show designed for, written for children. And yet, as you were saying, you know, Barbara's being sold in slavery and worse. And yet, you know, the Doctor walks on by.
Yeah. And it's like, you didn't see her.
It's like, don't look that way, Vicky. You know, you don't want to see that. We'll just ignore that part of history, which is what, you know, so many things actually do. I don't think they were making that grand point, though.
I think it was more like the joke of it was the farce of going out that door just as Barbara's coming in. It just so happened she's also being sold as a slave.
Yeah,
it was kind of odd, but it was funny. Like, there were bits, I mean, there were bits that were funny. I really liked that whole bit with the, like, royal poisoner, which I don't know if that is accurate or not, but I really enjoyed it. I felt like I was watching, like, a Mel Brooks film or something. Like, what was it? Yeah, Vicky was like, don't people take their revenge? And she went, yes, that's why I'm kept very busy.
Yeah.
It was real funny. Like, some bits actually really made me laugh.
The first bit that made me laugh was the poor man who had his tongue cut out, which was the assassin. The first, I guess, of a few. And he was wrestling the Doctor, and you saw the Doctor, you know, involved in fisticuffs.
Oh my God!
Which you would never see these days, and you were never associated with the Doctor. And when the poor guy went over, you saw his arse, clear as day.
I did not see that.
You missed that bit of bum.
Yeah, I did. What?
Yeah.
I did. I think maybe I was too busy scribbling because, yeah, that bit with the Doctor biting was bananas. And do you know what? Do you know what's so weird? Is that the episode... So wait, you watched The Rescue, didn't you, as well? Did you get to the end? It's fine if you didn't. You weren't obligated to watch it, but I just remember you mentioned that you had.
I didn't get to the end because somebody called me on Zoom and I had to talk to them.
All right.
But I wanted to find out. I was surprised because in my head, William Hartnell, and you have Susan. And then I suddenly realised Susan wasn't there.
And then it didn't click
with Vicky. And so I wanted to kind of find out how Vicky joined the gang. As it were, because I remembered why and how Susan and the actor who played Susan left, but I hadn't connected the Doctor with the replacement. So I was watching The Rescue.
Yes,
to put those pieces in place to find out, you know, who was this orphan from the 25th
century? Yeah. But I wanted to bring it up because he does sort of have a fight in The Rescue, and it really took me aback because normally, you know, Ian is action man. Yeah. And I remember watching this fight here and I was just like, doesn't William Hartnell leave because of his health next season? And but he's so good. He was really going for it. And he was bananas as well. He was just saying crazy stuff and jumping around. It was great.
I was perfectly happy when the guy got pushed out the window and presumably fell to his death. It was like,
yeah.
Oh, I was really enjoying that. Why did you go push him out the window, Vicky? That's not something you'd necessarily associate with Doctor Who.
I also really loved how flippant Vicky was about murdering Nero with the poison. She was just like, yeah. Well, he was going to poison a slave, and I didn't think that was very nice. So
yeah,
that's the whole thing was played for laughs. It was kind of it was kind of weird.
Yeah,
it was so strange. What I like about the Doctor and Vicky is, well, listen. Mm. It's commonplace on an episode for me to go on a big gush about Ian and especially Barbara, so I will do that. But I just want to quickly say about what I like about the Doctor and Vicky, because this is, I guess, the first episode that they've really been a team in any way, which is, I guess, I'm guessing why they gave them all this time in this episode.
Yes, I think established.
Yeah. I'm just realizing, but it's really nice for him to have someone to kind of show off a bit too. It's a bit more like it feels a bit more like modern Doctor and companion dynamic. Whereas Ian and Barbara are sort of like his caterers a bit, and they're like, now don't go over there, Doctor. You know that you always get into trouble. And I'm not even really sure him and Susan had quite that relationship, because I don't know. Like, it was more paternal, whereas Vicky's, it's like he's like, oh, great, I have another kid to play with. What do you think of Ian and Barbara? Because you've never met Ian and Barbara before.
I've met Ian and Barbara before.
I'm so sorry. Have you?
I'm familiar with many faces of the Doctor and a number of the companions.
I do apologize.
I like Ian and Barbara, but I am curious about their relationship. Because I say, like, this episode is a good example, you know, when they are separated and when they fear that their fates are going to be doomed, they just want to get back to each other. They just want to rescue each other. And it's quite clearly, you know, they're in love with each other. They never get it on. And as soon as they're back, you know, in safety, they're just kidding about with, with lame gags about fridges not existing in the Roman times.
That classic fridge gag.
I know. And then Ian somehow makes Barbara clean up his mess and just goes back enjoying like the lap of luxury whilst, you know, Barbara's back in a rightful place of being this kind of housewife to him.
Wait, no, but, because Barbara, listen...
Yeah,
Barbara's this is the best thing of Barbara bit is that she smashed she smashed that vase over his head by mistake.
She didn't mean to.
At a critical moment, which is hilarious already. The whole reason that they don't, not that that's the reason they don't make it out, but I feel like things could have been a lot different if Barbara, and look, not that I would ever criticize.
You're blaming Barbara. This all on Barbara. She was trying to do her best.
But I'm just saying,
best of intentions.
If she'd hit one of the guards, I'm just saying things might have played out a bit differently. So what happened is that Barbara smacked Ian over the head with that thing and then hilariously pretended she didn't, which was my favourite, probably my favourite moment of the whole thing, where he was, wait, what did she say? Hold on. Oh, yeah, he's like, oh, that's what they hit me on the head with. And she just gave him this amazing side eye and went, yes.
Yeah.
It's really funny. So, you know, I think eventually he was like, well, you can clean up that Baz, Barbara, seeing as you smacked me over the head with it.
I don't know. I was expecting more, you know. They'd risk life and limb to, you know, be reunited.
It was weird at the end how they were like, that was such a lark. Remember when I, remember when I was a slave and I was harassed for however long? Remember when I nearly died on a ship?
On a ship,
yeah. Remember when Ian tried to escape from that ship and it was the worst escape attempt ever? He just sort of leaned over and went like, and sort of
there was a lunge, but there was no idea what that lunge was leaning.
I think lunge is pretty generous.
Yeah, it's too much. It's too much.
That was really funny. Right. Ian and Barbara, on the one hand, right, I really love that they're just colleagues that get on and that they're pals. And I thought maybe in the 60s that was kind of nice, you know? I was like, oh, it's kind of nice that there's no... And listen, Barbara had a snog with a Thal in the first Dalek story. So, you know, that's... I'm not presuming you don't know these things.
I mean, if I haven't seen the episode, I've definitely listened to a good podcast review.
Right, okay, yeah. Like, I kind of like that they're pals, but also, if there's anything hinting at some romantic chemistry between Ian and Barbara, I'm on top of it, you know? So, I can't deny it.
Do you like the sort of couples that they're very good friends? They are. If only they could see each other, they'd get it. But, you know, they're just so repressed.
Sure.
Yeah. Do you have a thing for that?
And they're in the same workplace as well. So
I know, it's crazy. Yeah.
Ian's a chemistry teacher and Barbara's a history teacher.
Yeah.
I feel like there could have been more Barbara history teacher stuff in this. Because I like when we get a reminder. She did drop a couple of things, I think. Mm. A couple of nuggets, but I don't remember what they were now. But yeah, I did quite like it when things seemed to be ramping up a little bit. It was at the beginning when she was like blatantly checking Ian out as well. And then she did his hair, but not really. She like
she was gonna transform into a Roman, but all she did was get a bejeweled fork and drag it forward a little.
Yeah.
I was expecting her to shear it off or something.
Shear it off?
And it was like short back and stuff, but you know, still on that thing, right. Bobby.
This is the thing, when she was like, I'm going to give you a Roman hairdo, I was a bit like, what does she mean? Like, what is that exactly?
You've seen the statues, right?
I've seen the what?
Statues.
Oh, I suppose, yeah. I get it. Listen.
You see the coins.
This is... this is where my lack of history and knowledge is going to show.
That's why you have Doctor Who historicals.
Well, yeah. Exactly. Do you know what? That's true. That's what they were for. This was an educational show right now. So actually, the most authentic way to watch it is to be educated by it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how much of that is historically accurate. Is I presume the fire happened.
Yeah, the Great Fire happened in 64, and there was lots of different explanations for it, but I think one of them was Nero off safely playing his lyre whilst the city burned. So there were lots of kind of things kind of connecting it, but there was lots of other explanations for it, and it did happen by the circus where they said in the episode that's where it started.
I thought the arena would be a bit bigger.
Yeah, I don't think they had the budget for.
I'm gonna level with you. I was sort of picturing like Gladiator. And it was a small town hall sized room.
But why you expected a big budget CGI Roman amphitheater? I don't know why. They had a corridor to play with, and that was about it.
Do you know what really made me laugh about, so I was on, I'm not ashamed to say that I go on the TARDIS wiki, you know, to get some little nuggets of information for the podcast. But I was thinking about the fire and how it didn't really look real. I was like, is it real? Is it not real? I couldn't really figure it out just because of, I don't know, black and white and old.
The fire of the map or the fire of the home.
Any time there was anytime there was fire,
I don't know whether that was it's just to do with the black and white cameras.
So here's the line. It said the effect of Rome burning was done at the last minute when the budget had been exceeded. And then it says nobody was very happy with the result. That's it. Nobody was very happy with the result.
Oh, wow.
But
But I enjoyed Vicky and the Doctor sitting on the little rock, talking about kind of, you know, watching the Vicky's first historical event unfold. Yeah. The amazement of being there that kind of brought a bit of kind of like Doctor Who kind of wonder of it back into it.
And very different from, say, the fires of Pompeii, right? Where they mention this event, I think the 10th Doctor says something along, you know, references it.
Yeah.
It's like, well, that was nothing to do with me or something. Where they're watching Pompeii. Because this is what I was thinking, right? The Doctor, it's interesting. It's fun how gleeful he is that he inspired this event. But also, I was thinking, like, aren't, like, loads of people going to die in this fire? Like, and I was just thinking about how at the end of, you know, in the Fires of Pompeii, where he has to, like, he has to decide to make that happen, to make that event happen. And there's that, like, really beautiful moment where him and Donna basically press a big button that blows it up. And it's really sad, and they're both incredible. And then they stand, you know, on the edge of the city and watch it burn and know all these people are dying. And I know it's not quite the same context and it's not the same sort of level of disaster, but
I think a whole city did almost burn, maybe.
But we can presume that, come on, a lot of people must have died in that fire, right? We can assume that.
Definitely, relatively, yeah. I mean, it had to be rebuilt.
Right, yeah. So if not, you know, lots of people died, lots of people left destitute. The Doctor's like, silly me.
Yeah. I liked, just like in Modern Who, where the Doctor always kind of drops little tidbits about, you know, being somewhere and inspiring, you know, great events. And the whole Emperor's New Clothes sort of kind of bit, where he pretends to play the lyre. Of course, he can't play that bit. So he tells everybody that, you know, only people with very good hearing can hear me, and then just mimes it all. And then he later chuckles that, you know, he gave Hans Christian Andersen that idea.
Yeah.
And yeah, which is very, you know, very modern.
It's a real Modern Who thing to do, right? And I think he has done it before, William Hartnell's Doctor, but I think it was a lot earlier on. I can't remember when, but I think it was earlier on in the first series, and I was like, oh, I didn't. It definitely doesn't happen as often. So I got excited as well about Hans Christian Andersen. Yeah. Also, so I wanted to talk a little bit about Nero. Right, so when Nero first when Nero first appeared, I was so on board because I was like, this guy's having a great time. He was eating his chicken leg. He gave his chicken leg to the Doctor. It was great. He was like, I think that actor was quite a big actor at the time. And I think it was the first time they kind of scored a big name. Yeah, he was having a great time, and so was I. And there were so many bits throughout it that I enjoyed him. I liked all his weird soliloquies. So now in season two, sometimes there's a soliloquy, almost to camera.
Ian was all about that.
Really? What, just saying things to himself? Like,
yeah, well, he was off quoting stuff, and Barbara was rolling her eyes at him.
Oh no, but this is different. He was doing a bit, like, he was like, I'm going to recite some Shakespeare now. I mean, Nero came out of a room and was like, and now I will explain my plan, you know?
Sorry.
I know the whole thing was farcical, but it was kind of just too uncomfortable when he was chasing poor Barbara around the room. It was like, I couldn't even, like, get behind the comedy of it. It was just too rough. I was like, oh no, I can't.
It was, at best, it was very Benny Hill, and that's
At best, it was what?
Benny Hill, and that's not a compliment.
Right. This is something I am wondering about.
Yeah.
Is his name Tivius? The guy that kind of saves Barbara.
Yes.
Which at first I scoffed at, because when he buys her and he was like, listen, you know, this is going to be a way better situation for you. And he's like, unfortunately, I can't free you though. And I was like, oh, why can't, if you want to do a nice thing, you know, why don't you just buy Barbara and then give it, you know, and then, but then I realized like actually what his capacity was as the, yeah. I don't know, within the court or whatever. And then obviously he's part of the conspiracy. That bit at the end, he helps them escape, I think. And he's got a little cross and he's like,
yeah.
They make a big show of him kind of like holding it like I did the right thing. So what?
Well, Nero blamed the city burning on the Christian community of Rome.
Really?
Yeah. And okay. So I think it was a hint to that. That's why, you know, that's why the guy secretly wanted Nero dead. That's why the musician who thought the doctor was, that's why he's conspiring with him to kill Nero.
This is all the historical context I was missing. Yeah. But this is good because if you do know that, you get, I guess if you don't know that, right, you still have enough information to enjoy the episode. But if you do know that, then it's interesting.
Yeah.
So the stock footage.
Oh, I was about to say of the lions.
Yeah. But I also thought maybe when they were on the boat. Mm. Yeah, I was like, how did they do? Yeah, like I was like, come on, they've just gone
to the library and they've just you know, some waves.
Yeah, but that was but
they got a lion. They've got a bit of a tiger.
But listen, the boat wasn't as obviously stock footage, but the lions and clearly in a zoo.
Yeah.
That's fun.
You can see, like, you know, the zookeeper behind, you know, feeding a gorilla.
Yeah, that's real fun. And they used it for, I think, the cliffhanger, and then they were like, no, but we're not going to see them in action.
No. So.
No, they're like, no, you can fight each other. It's no big deal.
we hear the lions later, but we never see them.
No.
No, just a distant roar.
Yeah. I think that's pretty much it. So, what were your main takeaways from this?
I suppose it reminded me of the fact that Doctor Who can be, and has been, several different types of shows.
Hmm.
Like you're saying, this is a purely historical one. There's nothing sci-fi in this at all. And sometimes we kind of, in the modern one, it's all about the end of the universe. Or it's necessarily all about intense, you know, kind of personal drama. And so then when you throw in a Robin Hood, it sometimes seems a bit out of place. But actually, this is what Doctor Who's always been about. In fact, that's how it got its, you know, how it got its commissioned in the first place, because it was there to educate as well as, you know, anything else. And so, yeah, I had a lovely time, and now you can take that away from me.
What's interesting is I feel like historicals generally have a reputation for being more of an emotional episode because the past is emotional, and I think I spoke a lot about this on the Aztecs, where the Aztecs is quite an emotional episode, and it's all about Barbara and her figuring out that she can't change things about the past, horrible things about the past, and then you've got your Vincent and the Doctor and your Rosa, and yeah, especially when they're about specific people, I suppose. Specific inspirational people, but also like the fires of Pompeii or like tragic events that have happened. So it was kind of cool to see one that was unabashedly a comedy, even though it was tonally wacky. Like it was so strange that these like really grim things were happening, but it was a comedy, and it was a bit weird considering, I don't know, the way Doctor Who normally functions. But I did enjoy that it was a comedy, and like it was so fun for there to be gags, honestly. Like, it was just so silly and quick and a laugh, and it's really funny. And you know, it's just nice to see, because I've been with I've been with these actors a while now, right, from the start, and it was just nice to see them get to do that, especially William Hartnell. Like, he had so much more energy, and he was just a bit more sprightly. I mean, physically as well. Like, I mean, there was the fighting.
Well, and in the previous episode, he just kept nodding off to sleep.
Yeah.
For large parts of it.
And wait, yet which now... one? Wait, the rescue?
Yeah, at the very beginning, he's always having a snooze.
I can't remember that, but I remember in the Dalek Invasion of Earth, he was always having a snooze.
Yeah. Didn't even notice the TARDIS had landed.
Oh god, at the beginning of the rescue, he was having a snooze. They have to wake him up. They're like, hello.
And so, yet he walks to Rome from wherever the hell they are.
Rome.
And
it was really good to see a proper episode with Vicky, and I feel like you got to see a bit more of her personality, and it's really good to have, it is really nice having someone. I never feel like they use Susan enough. It's nice to have someone that's young and curious and and also that, like, is maybe like a bit like naughtier as well. Like, well, I know, like, maybe that's like a tame. I don't mean that her literally setting out to murder someone should be seen as merely a naughty thing to do, but
that is what he kind of
you know, she's fun and enjoy her. I mean, I have still some like funny things that he said. Like, I liked when Vicky went, oh, the poor man, that, and the doctor went, yes, he's dead. And also and she was like, oh, but I know him, and he went, yes, well, there's nothing we can do for him now, dear. And then I really like when the guard went, is that your lyre? And he went, why, have you lost one? Like, it's just so good. Like, it was just really dense with jokes. Mm-hmm. It was kind of strange and fun. It was something new. It's always something new right now with Classic Who.
Well, I mean, because you're starting at the very beginning.
I know, but like, it's nice. It's sort of like not had the chance to repeat itself yet, which I think modern Who kind of does, or I think me and Cassie were talking about this a little bit. It does categorize itself a little bit, you know. You have episodes that are like this and episodes that are like this, and
after so many decades,
it's not a criticism, it's just sort of a novelty right now.
There's one very strange, I mean, a lot of the camera angles and shots, I mean, I quite like old Who about how economical and efficient they have to be. It often gets derided for that, but I actually think it's I find it quite clever that they are able to take you into many different places in the exact same room, just change a, you know, like a light bulb, move a bit of furniture around, and you're in a completely different universe. But they were in the kind of sauna area. And so the doctor was having all the steam room, you know, somewhere, one of the many parts of Roman bath. And the doctor and Emperor Nero were having a bit of a stolen together. Yeah. But you didn't really know, because it focused in on Emperor Nero's foot in a slightly rather kind of erotic way. And then it panned up his naked leg.
Yeah.
It was quite a while before it revealed that it was, you know, them just having a sauna, and you're thinking, where's this going?
I was thinking that too. I was also confused about that scene as to why is his assistant just incompetent? Because, like, it's not even like he went, so he pours boiling water over his legs, but it's not like he's aiming for somewhere else. He just comes in, pours it on his legs, leaves.
He's the fool of the piece, or one of many fools.
Well, sure.
Skipping over, you know.
But I feel like for example, right, the gag where he's trying to put the crown on his head. I guess the joke is like he's trying to do his job. He's trying to do his job. And he's trying to put the crown on his head, but Nero keeps running around because he's a bumbling fool.
Trying to rape Barbara.
Yeah. And he can't put the crown on his head while his boss is being a sex pest. But in this scene, he literally just walks in, pours scalding water on him and leaves.
Yeah. But that's to rouse them and to get them up and for them to start talking about, you know.
Well, yeah.
You know.
I guess. Okay. It doesn't seem like the best place to finish it, does it? But I did enjoy it. It was very funny.
I did. I thought the doctor had he was less curmudgeon-y. He had a bit more style and suave about him.
He was quite campy. Especially at the start, when he was talking about the food.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, for me at least, and certainly in Modern Who, you never see people eating. You never see people drinking, really.
Wait, sorry, on TV?
Yeah, no, on Doctor Who.
Oh, okay. Don't you?
Well, Matt Smith once had a glass of wine and then he spat it out. And it's terrible stuff. But, at the beginning, they were, all getting drunk and having a whale of a good time.
I was thinking this when Barbara and Ian suddenly got attacked. I remember at some point thinking, oh, those poor things, and they're probably a bit pissed as well. Oh, yeah, no wonder Barbara missed Ian's head.
Exactly.
Oh, no wonder she hit Ian on the head.
Yeah.
I was also thinking when that happened, I usually love it when Barbara chucks things or runs people over or... into it. It's because she's got so much poise. Like, she looks so great. She looks so graceful and beautiful, and her hair is always immaculate. Today was no exception.
No.
And then sometimes she just chucks a cup or runs over a bunch of Daleks. She's just like, I'm done with this today. But it wasn't the best moment when she accidentally took out Ian at the critical moment.
Do you relate to her occasional clumsiness?
How rude. You come on here, you start throwing accusations around.
I mean, I only say that because you're both equally poised.
But I could not get my hair to be as immovable as Barbara's. Maybe one day.
Maybe one day.
You know, it's good to have goals. Yeah. All right. I think we'll round it up there. What do you reckon?
Yeah. Well, you're the expert.
Yeah. It is my podcast, that's true.
Yeah, you get to call the shots.
Okay, so can you tell people where they can follow you and stuff?
Yes. Down a street in Wakefield.
No, on the digital plane. If they want to see, your Instagram pictures of Wakefield, where can they find them?
It would be a waste of people's time to go to the effort to look.
Do you not want to share this?
So I'm not going to inflict them.
No, that's fine. Them. Well,
you
don't.
know.
All right, that's fair.
But I will plug my book, if that's okay.
What?
My first volume on my memoirs. Education in Reverse is coming out in early December.
What did you say it was called?
Education in Reverse.
Right, okay.
Future Shona coming to you from the Time Vortex here. In lieu of an Instagram handle, I'm letting Andy plug a fictional book. This is what I'm letting my guests do these days. So I am sorry to say that no matter what he says, you will not be able to find Education in Reverse available in any bookshop. But maybe in a hypothetical future situation where I had merch, maybe I'll call Andy's bluff and get him to write Education in Reverse. Who knows?
So we haven't got a final date, but it should be the first week of December. All good bookstores. If you get in there early, you might get a signed copy.
Oh my god, and what if your birthday's the first week of December?
Well, then let's hope you got some some good friends to, you know, be an ideal present.
So you don't get one for free? Do you know how many people have a birthday the first week of December?
I can't think of a single person.
Okay, right. I'm rounding it up.
Okay.
Okay. This has been My Adventure in Space and Time. We've been Shona and Andy. Bye!
My Adventure in Space and Time is hosted and produced by Shona Stevenson, with music by Shona Stevenson and artwork by Robbie Stevenson. Special thanks to Caroline Donald for all her support and to anyone listening. You can hear more on the website at myadventureinspace.wixsite.com/podcast or on Spotify, Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. Please join the conversation on Facebook, Twitter or Instagram at myadventurepod. Thanks for coming along on the adventure.
Before I go, I just want to tell you, you were fantastic. Absolutely fantastic.